This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, the Playing With Food team takes a look at backyard chickens.
So usually I fill up their water and throw them some mealworms like my mom just did, and I'll come and pet them for a second and say hi.
Also, we'll hear from the director of Cal Poly Arts, Molly Clark.
So I have relationships with artists and relationships with agents that I really trust and can kind of brainstorm about what we think will resonate with our audience here.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 25th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. As part of an interdisciplinary senior project, a team of Cal Poly engineering students is working to help out a fellow student by building her a new prosthetic. Here's KCBX's Serena Grossi speaking with the team and their sponsor to talk about their year-long project.
I'm Emma Carangella. I'm a fourth-year biomedical engineering major.
I'm Don Baditz, a fourth-year mechanical engineering student, and I use she, her pronouns.
This is, like, so crazy. my name's Cameron Yartz. I'm a fourth-year mechanical engineering major, and I use he, him pronouns.
Can I just get some, like, general information on the project, like how it got started?
So I was born without my left hand, and I've had different prosthetics over the years, but for the last 6 years, I've had what's called the TRS prosthetic, and it's helped me with weightlifting and grabbing things like that. And then last year, in Introduction to Biomedical Engineering Design, the project was to design a device based on improving a device. And so my team and I decided to improve my prosthetic, as at that point it was starting to break and no longer work for me. And so we kind of did the preliminary like engineering requirements and kind of looking at what I would want in the device, but that class is very preliminary stages, no prototyping or building of any kind. And the professor of that class, Carla Krickner, had asked if I wanted to take it as my senior project, but I had already agreed to one. And so to their class I went and presented my situation, and then these three came forward, and yeah, that's where they came in. So it's been great.
So we're all in interdisciplinary senior projects, so it's a mix of different engineering disciplines. And at the beginning of the year, we had Maddie come in and she talked about her hand and the opportunity to make a new prosthetic for her. And we all were just really excited by the opportunity. And we all put this one as the first one, and we all got it. And we get to kind of combine our different engineering disciplines together, which is really neat.
What other kind of like projects were up for grabs?
There's a lot that are sponsored by big corporations. So like Edwards Life Sciences has a lot of heart valve projects, a lot of BMed focus. There's a firefighter like respirator project. There's a ocean lander that's getting some data from the seafloor. There's a football helmet sensor for concussions. There's just a really wide variety of projects, but this is the only like bespoke prosthetic project that was offered, and I think we all really liked that idea.
I'm not sure about you two, but I hadn't met either of my teammates until we all got selected. We all came back, we all got our first choice, and then that was our team. And so I met them then, and so it was really exciting to be joining a team where we all, like, this was what we wanted to do out of the choices available.
So that's interesting. Like, you guys didn't really know each other well. Did that, like, affect, like, the process at all?
Yeah, it's always interesting working with a group of people. And especially at school, like, you probably have been in classes where, you know, you get into a group and it's really not that, nobody really cares about the project or anything. But it was immediately pretty clear from the beginning that we all cared about this project. And that was really bonding for us is, hey, this was all our first choice. We actually want to deliver a cool device for Maddie at the end of all of this. So let's actually work hard at this. They had us go and do a meal together in the beginning of the quarter. So we went and got pizza. And I think only one of us got pizza. And we just sat there and talked. But actually caring about the project like really quickly brought us together.
Something that like really drew me to the project was that it's like working directly with another student. And I was wondering if you guys could like kind of speak more on that. Was that part of like what intrigued you?
So it definitely has driven us to try and reach like the extra quality on there, because we know that the final product that we're going to make is actually hopefully going to be used and make a difference in someone's life.
It's also been really neat to get Maddie's feedback, because she's an engineering student as well. So her feedback is pretty educated on the topics that we're focusing on. It's not just like, oh, this doesn't feel great. It's like, oh, well, maybe we could use this instead. Like, I don't know. It's just kind of more helpful that she's engineering, which is awesome. So it's kind of like we're all collaborating together on it.
Am I correct with the prosthetic that it's supposed to be helping you with like weightlifting, right?
Mm-hmm. So, contrary to the article, I'm not a mega bodybuilder. However, it's the one area of my life that I can't just go in and pick something up and start doing it. Not being able to hold something with a true grip really affects my ability to not only weight train, but weight train so that I'm not causing differences in my shoulders or my hips or like my arms, like causing pain elsewhere in my body. As someone who goes pretty frequently to the gym with my roommates or with friends, like I would like to be able to just go in and not have to modify my exercises or not be able to do something completely. And so that was kind of the idea. In its true form, it's really just something that can grab something, which is kind of the biggest limitation with my hand. And so when I am able to go in with my prosthetic and do the exercises, I think it's really rewarding for me. I get to feel like, you know, my friends do it, I get to do it too. And like, I don't know, I get to feel physically fit. And I think being able to do that just really makes me feel good about myself. Like, I love trying to be the best and healthiest version of myself. And so that really is part of it as well.
Yeah. I was wondering if you're like comfortable, if you could like describe more about your disability.
Totally.
Stuff.
Yeah, so I was born without the formation of my left hand, and it's a two-part disability. So my ulna and my radius are fused at my elbow all the way down to my wrist, which causes issues with rotation. And then my hand is fully deformed, and so my latter four fingers don't have bones in them. And so my thumb is the only one that is able to move. The doctors don't know. It's kind of an anomaly. It wasn't amniotic bands or anything genetic. So it was kind of just a surprise. So the biggest issue, besides being able to like grip things, is the fusion of my bones can cause a lot of nerve pain and nerve issues just with how they're all formed. I've had it my whole life, so I think that's also part of something that is helpful to me in a sense, like this is all I know, instead of having it change at a certain point in my life.
Yeah, so like one of the first things we did was we got to look at her current prosthetic device, which has like a few issues. The prosthetic is 7 years old, it doesn't quite fit right, and then it's also not really designed to be used with a hand like Maddie's. So it's designed more for like a full amputee where they don't have a hand. It's like adjusted out of its proper range, and so it broke. It can't hold anything without spinning. It's kind of a mess. So that was like our starting point, is once we figured all that out, we were able to start making some decisions on what designs could potentially be useful.
I guess, what are like the main ways that the new prosthetic will be differing from the old one?
So one of the main things is we're trying to make a prosthetic that fits Maddie's arm perfectly, and it just wasn't really designed for an arm like hers, so we're designing something that actually fits. I don't think we've talked about this yet, but we've been working with Hanger Clinic in SLO, and they're a prosthetics and orthotics company, and some of the prosthetists there have really emphasized the importance of prosthetic fit, and if somebody is going to wear a prosthetic, they're not gonna wanna wear it at all if it doesn't fit perfectly. So that's one of the huge improvements with this project, is the goal is for it to fit super snug to her arm, first of all for comfort, and then also for safety, because she's going to be lifting super heavy weights.
The team is currently in the final phase of building the prosthetic. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. First, it was the pandemic in 2020 when supply chains were closed off. Then it was avian flu in 2022 when flocks were being destroyed. People bought chickens. Urban chickens, those city slicker fowl, are all the rage. It makes sense. The average American eats about 275 eggs a year. So if they are in short supply or really expensive, someone with a decent backyard may want to build a hen house. Among those in the know, they are referred to as backyard chickens, but Playing with Food is focusing specifically on urban chickens, ones that live in the city where they might annoy neighbors or be involved in cockfights in the street. That's a lot more edgy than someone who lives a mile out of town, whose closest neighbor is a half mile and their backyard could sustain a big box store. But for a segment on urban chickens, where do you start? With the chicken or the egg? The Playing with Food team started with the recently hatched chick. The perfect compromise.
My name is Megan Raff, and I am a co-owner of Dare to Dream Farms in Lompoc, California. And we primarily set people up with backyard chickens so that they can keep chickens as pets and for egg production in their backyard.
You provide them with the chickens at what age? Are they already laying when you get them?
Well, we raise them so that they can be sold at all different age groups. Some families want to share the experience of raising baby chicks together. Others don't have the space or time or inclination to do so, and they just want chickens that can go straight into the coop. So we have five different age groups: baby chicks, which are up to 2 weeks old. We have coop-ready chickens, which are over the 6 weeks, so they're fully feathered. They can go straight into the coop and they don't need any supplemental heat. And then we have two age groups older than that that just get you closer to egg laying age.
You probably get asked this question a lot, but when you're raising chickens to give away, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, we don't do any hatching here. That comes with its own specialty set of equipment and knowledge and skills. What we do is source from NPIP certified hatcheries across the United States. We work with two primarily. Those hatcheries hatch a variety of chickens. We choose the ones that are the most well suited for beginner backyard chicken keepers, ones that are good producers, fairly friendly, easy to keep, hardy, so that they can be cold tolerant and heat tolerant and disease resistant, and make it an easy transition so that this is something that households and families want to continue doing. I'll take you up to the barn.
Oh, look how cute.
Yes. As you can see, we've got quite a few different partitions, and each of the partitions has a different age group of chickens. Now, it's not so much that you need to separate them out by their type. They can actually get along well in a group of a variety of different breeds. But if you mix them into different age groups, the big chickens try and get the little chickens to assimilate into their pecking order. And while they don't intend to hurt them, the sheer size of the older chickens can really hurt the younger ones.
Is it like gangs?
It can be. Chickens do actually have an awful habit of sticking with other breeds that look like them. So if you were to have a flock where you had two of one breed, two of another, and then this other chicken that doesn't look like anyone, they will actually congregate with the other chicken that looks like them. And the one that doesn't have anybody that looks like them is kind of a third wheel. So we tell people either to get multiple pairs of twos or to just get all different chickens, because they're fine if they all look different. They do well in a group, they hang out and love each other, but if you give them the opportunity to group with other chickens that look like them, they'll take it.
So how many chickens do you have at any one point in time? Like, what's the most chickens you have?
We bring in approximately 1,000 birds every 5 weeks in the spring. And what we used to do was bring in like 200 to 500 birds every week or other week. And what we found was it's easier for counting chickens because they move if we just know how many we have and work off that inventory rather than having a constant influx of chickens into each age group. So we were always having to do inventory and it was always wrong because, like, did I count you already? But I'll show you where they start out. This is one of our brooders.
How cute!
So these ones just hatched on Wednesday. And we received them yesterday. They get set up with heat lamps and some chick waterers, which are lower to the ground so that they can reach them, and baby chick feed. In addition to the fresh pine shavings, we make sure that we sanitize everything before we set up their brooder. And then as we put the chicks into the brooder, we take their little beaks and dip them in the water one by one to make sure that they know where to get hydration. And once they're all hydrated and warm and feeling fanciful after their long travels, then they'll start to explore their surroundings and find their food and play and dust bathe and even sunbathe. So you can see some of them are under the heat lamps. You'll see some of them kind of preening their feathers and stretching their wings out. And it's basically like a little chick spa day. Once they are off of the heat lamps, which occurs around 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the weather and how fast they are feathering out, we'll move them to a different part of the barn into a different run space so that we can free up this space for a new set of baby chicks.
Okay.
Back here, there's a couple different age groups that have been growing up.
Wow, you just got 1,000 two-day-old chickens. What do they come in?
They come in little cardboard boxes. There are specific boxes that you can ship poultry in. And they have to meet a bunch of different regulations. They've got tons of ventilation. They have little padding in there so that they aren't just kind of slipping around on the bottom of a cardboard box. And then they put something in there called grow gel, which is a green powder. And when mixed with water, it grows into something that's very much like Dippin' Dots or Jell-O. And it's the sustenance that the chicks need should they run out of the sustenance that they're hatched with. So when they're forming in the shell, the last thing that happens is that they absorb all the nutrients from the yolk before they hatch so that they can survive for approximately 24 to 48 hours outside of the shell while the mama finishes off hatching all the other eggs.
Oh, wow.
Because since they don't hatch exactly at the same time, the mom can't just get up and abandon the nest and take the hatchlings out to find food and water. So they kind of have to be self-sufficient for the first little while, which allows them to be shipped easily. And then they just put the grow gel in there for their comfort and just in case the shipping takes a little longer than they anticipate.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian in Lompoc, surrounded by baby chickens. According to one estimate, about 12 million households have urban chickens. They have to come from somewhere, and on the Central Coast, they come from Dare to Dream in Lompoc, where Megan is showing me how to raise a chicken supply. And one thing I never considered was biosecurity.
So biosecurity is making sure that the environment that the chickens are in is controlled in a way that helps manage the exposure of viral, bacterial, or any other type of infection for the chickens, and also external and internal parasites. A lot of that stuff is brought in for chickens on human clothing, human shoes, equipment that comes from outside sources, or even vectors such as rodents or flies or things like that. We have certain systems in place that help us prevent things from entering this facility so that we can make sure that all the chickens are healthy. For fly control, we're making sure to use what's called fly eliminators. It's a actual parasitic wasp, and they lay their eggs in the larva of flies so that they cannot procreate. We also have tons of sticky traps and wasp traps and things like that. As we did when we entered, we made sure that our shoes were cleaned before we walked in. The wheels of wheelbarrows will get bleached or shovels will get bleached to make sure that we're sanitizing all the equipment that comes in here to be used in this area. Biosecurity does not compromise a certified organic laying flock. We are not certified organic for the laying flock. If you wanted to raise chickens and have them certified organic later, there is a period of time prior to egg laying that the chickens have to be fed organic feed, but it does not require that the chickens are fed organic feed or not vaccinated from the time that they're hatched up until that point in time. So most feeds that are medicated or things of that nature that they want to eliminate from organic certifications, those will all get processed by the body of the chicken within usually about 4 to 6 weeks.
But honestly, how popular is urban chicken raising? Well, according to the 2021-2022 National Pet Owners Survey, I know that's a bit old, by the American Pet Products Association, ownership of backyard chickens went from 8% in 2018 to 13% in 2020. And of course, millennials and Gen Z top ownership by generation. What Megan experienced as a supplier bears that out. It seems, though, if you're doing this all year round and you have 1,000 chickens every 5 weeks,
that
it's really popular.
It is. It originally started back in the early 2000s and really took hold during the crash of 2008. So my husband and I had moved out here to take care of his grandfather, who'd recently lost his wife. And we started raising chickens just to keep him busy. And we started having more eggs than we knew what to do with. We started selling the eggs locally. There was a huge demand. We got more chickens. And all of a sudden, we started getting calls, do you sell your chickens? And they didn't stop. We had people saying, you should bring your chickens down to LA. I know a ton of people that are looking. So we started raising chickens, and it was definitely a growing hobby that formed a ton of different meetup groups across LA County, Ventura County, all the way up to the Bay Area. We were serving all the way down to San Diego at some point. And it didn't really slow down too much, but especially in 2020, when people realized that the food systems that we have in place are not actually as reliable as we imagined that they were, everyone wanted to have a little bit more control about where they were getting their food from. And it just makes sense to start with chickens because they're so pet-like. It's so easy. We call it the gateway farm animal. You can start with 2 chickens and have 12 eggs a week, easy. And the cleanup is minimal, the maintenance is minimal. All you're doing is putting out feed maybe once a week. You can use an automatic waterer, just make sure it stays clean. Collect your eggs on a daily basis. And depending on how small the cage is for those 2 chickens, I mean, you could be cleaning it once a month. You could be cleaning it every week if it's pretty small, but the amount of effort that you have to put in order to get 12 eggs a week is really reasonable, considering that the quality of egg that you're getting is something that you'd pay $10 or $12 for at a farmer's market. So it made sense for a lot of families to just secure at least a protein source for themselves over the pandemic. So over the pandemic, we were bringing in between 2,000 to 3,000 birds, baby chicks, a week.
Wow.
And they were selling on our website in 15 minutes. I couldn't keep them in stock. I probably could have sold 10,000 birds a week. I just didn't have the facilities for it. And we also like to vet our customers a little bit and make sure that they're truly ready for the chicken experience.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm surrounded by urban chickens. No joke. I live in the middle of San Luis Obispo, and 2 of my neighbors have chickens. Amanda and her daughter Rue recently got their chickens from Megan at Dare to Dream.
My name is Amanda Radakovich. I work at Mind Body, so nothing related to chickens, but...
And what do we have here?
We have our chicken coop, which is in our backyard, and it's built between our garage and the fence in our backyard. We had a pretty good space that we decided to finish out as a chicken coop.
So I'm interested in what I call urban chickens. I know they're called backyard chickens, but mm-hmm. I call them urban chickens. And you are in the middle of...
San Luis Obispo.
Right. So we're in the middle of town. You can hear the cars go by.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's look at your chickens.
Yeah. You can hear probably Penny. She's the loudest one and the oldest and biggest one. But my daughter Rue can probably introduce the rest of them.
So we have a black and white one. It's striped. And that one I named Zebra. And then we have 2 brown ones. They're different kinds, but we have Cookie and Penny. And then we have an olive egger that is kind of feisty. Her name is Olive because she's an olive egger. And then we have Lexi. She is a black sex link. We have Goldie, and she is a gold chicken, and we like her a lot.
How long have you had these chickens?
About like 2.5 months, 1.5 months.
When did you decide to get chickens and why?
Well, I really wanted chickens for Christmas because we had had them before and I really liked them. And yeah, so.
Here you are. Okay, so what do you have to do every day with your chickens? Because there's chicken poop and your mom's throwing out mealworms and all sorts of things. So what do you have to do on a daily basis to keep these chickens?
So usually I come in and fill up their water and usually throw them some mealworms like my mom just did. And I'll come and pet them for a second and say hi, and then I'll just go out, and then like every other day I'll do that, and usually I put them in the roost for the night.
Are they producing eggs?
Not yet. We think in like 1 month, since it's been about like 2 months already.
I live across the driveway from you, and I saw this being built.
Yeah,
it was great. So where did you get your chickens?
They came from a farm called Dare to Dream, and they are a local chicken breeder. The first set of chickens we had probably 5 years ago now came from them, and they just always produce a lot of heritage breeds, really interesting varieties. They're really well cared for. You can get chickens from them at any age, so you can get chicks or pullets or even just already laying hens if you're wanting to get eggs right away. So the last four chickens we had came from Dare to Dream, and they were really healthy, great layers, and then we didn't have this enclosed, and so they kept flying over. They weren't flying over this fence, but they were flying into our yard all the time because we had built this gate portion, but they could fly over the gate, and they were destroying everything in our yard because they are pretty destructive by nature. You can see they're scratching at the ground. That's what they spend the majority of their day doing, is finding bugs and worms and grubs, and they eat, like, this was all full of weeds when we started, and they eat all of those down as well. So if you're looking for them to take care of our garden after it's done producing, they're excellent for that. But if you have like planted flowers, you definitely want to be able to enclose the chickens because they will definitely scratch them all up. We struggled with that for a while with those chickens, and then I actually rehomed them to a friend that had a ranch, and they're free-range chickens living their best lives. But Rue wanted to, she's 8 now, so she's able to help care for them and take responsibility. So we wanted to give it another go and have eggs.
I just rewatched Chicken Run because Chicken Run 2 just came out.
Yes.
And I started watching Chicken Run 2, but then I fell asleep, so I have to watch it. But chickens can't fly.
As far as I can tell from the chickens that I've had, they can't fly like long distances, but they can certainly help themselves up into places. So the two lighter chickens that we had, I think a Rhode Island Red and an Easter Egger, were able to just basically hop from like here and kind of fly themselves up over this gate. And we didn't want to take any risks with these. The other two that we had previously were really robust hens, and so I don't think they were quite light enough to be able to jump and kind of flap their way high enough to get out. So we'll kind of see as these guys all grow up how they, you can see like that one back there, she kind of looks like a raptor, like a velociraptor almost. She's more upright and she's a lot taller, and I think she would be more capable of flying higher, whereas some of the lower ones that are a little more chunky, let's say, those are the ones that seem to not be able to get so high.
So you just picked up and pet a chicken. Are they friendly like pets?
Yes, they are very friendly, but the one in the back that looks like the velociraptor is kind of feisty. Sometimes she's a little scared, and if you try to pick her up, she'll kind of nip at you. Sometimes we don't pick her up that often, but the other ones are really nice, and we like to pet them a lot.
Have you ever been injured by a chicken?
Not exactly. I've only got scratched by one.
So what's required to maintain them and to keep them disease-free, to make sure that they stay healthy and have the room that they need to live?
One thing I really liked about Dare to Dream is they come pre-vaccinated against a lot of the different problems that chickens can have. I think one exposure is a risk of actual other birds coming in and interacting with the chickens and potentially spreading parasites and other things. So having this enclosed is actually better for the chickens in that they still have a lot of fresh air, but no other birds can get inside of here, and they're at less risk of contracting anything from neighborhood birds and wild birds.
So that's everything about raising chickens. What about the eggs? Let's go back to Lompoc to find out.
Yes, the color of the yolk, but also there's a few other indicators. A really fresh egg from a very healthy chicken has body, it has shape. A lot of eggs that you crack from the grocery store, they fall flat in the pan. It just looks like oil. It just kind of plops into the pan and spreads out really far because it doesn't hold itself together. Mm. But a really fresh egg doesn't spread out that far. It falls into the pan, it holds itself together. You can tell that the egg white has shape. You can tell that the egg yolk stands up tall. Fresh and healthy egg whites are also actually really creamy. They're not actually translucent like the ones that you find in the grocery store. And then there's also one more indicator of freshness, and that's the chalaza, a tiny little membrane that holds the yolk in the center of the egg. If the egg is super fresh and you crack it in there, you'll actually find two. They kind of look like little white swirlies, and that was used to hold the yolk in the center of the egg, and they don't disappear super quick. So if you find those in the egg, it's actually a sign that the chicken's egg is very, very fresh.
Okay. There are many pitfalls, but I'll highlight only one of them, the cost-benefit ratio.
So I would caution anyone who's interested in it. It's certainly a hobby, and your passion for caring for the animals themselves is an important part of the journey, because it's a lot cheaper to just buy eggs than it is to buy chicken food and care for the chickens. You would have to be committed to the idea of caring for these birds for the length of their life and not just getting the benefit of the eggs, but also enjoying watching them and kind of having fun learning from the chicken experience overall.
So it is more expensive.
I think it might be an economies of scale situation where when you have a lot of birds and you have enough eggs to be able to sell and they help pay for caring for the birds, you can definitely be a chicken chicken keeper, a backyard chicken owner, and make it very affordable and probably have it balance out with the cost of eggs. But with all the treats, like we buy the little mealworms and the things to feed them because they're fun, they're pets, you know, so we enjoy interacting with them. So we want them to have the best, just like you would for your cat or your dog.
Whether from your backyard in the middle of a city or from a farm far, far away, eggs come from chickens. Chicken comes from chickens. Chickens are live birds. So one last very important note.
I think it's important for people and kids to know where food comes from. So whenever there's an opportunity to milk a cow or go to a farm and see and make the connections of the things that end up on your table or on your plate, started somewhere else. Witnessing that whole journey and taking part in it whenever you can, I think is really important for all people to appreciate at least.
This is KCPX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, correspondent Tom Wilmer and his intern, Addie Uhl, meet with Molly Clark, Cal Poly Arts Director.
Molly Clark, here we are at Cal Poly State University. You have one of the coolest jobs. Tell us a little bit about your world.
Sure. So I'm director of Cal Poly Arts, which is the university presenter on campus. So basically my job is to oversee the organization, but my main job is to curate a performing arts season. So we put on 30 to 40 performances a year typically.
Wow.
In all sorts of genres. We try to cover as many of the performing arts disciplines as we can. So dance, Broadway, speakers, mm-hmm. all different genres of music.
How do you curate? How do you find the potential candidates? And do you have like a committee that you'll kind of round robin?
I don't have a committee. I definitely listen to the feedback from the audience. I listen to the feedback from my colleagues here on staff, but also my colleagues around the country who do this sort of work.
It follows your referral network, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a very small world of us who present in the performing arts. And so we talk frequently. I would say the main way that I'm curating is I'm trying to experience as much performing arts as possible. So I'm going to festivals. I'm going to conferences. I am consuming as much sort of footage online of different musicians and artists. Of course, live in person is the best way to experience it. And then I've been doing this for a long time. So I have relationships with artists and relationships with agents that I really trust and can kind of brainstorm about what we think will resonate with our audience here. And every audience and every market is different.
So intuitively, it's twofold. You're on campus, it's a campus facility. So it follows deductive reasoning that you're presenting stuff for the students that would resonate with them.
Right.
But, you know, I'm old dog and I come whenever I can to your performances from the community. So you have the duality, right?
Absolutely. You stated it perfectly. We are trying to find artists that resonate with our campus community. So not just the students, but our staff and faculty too. And I'm often looking for artists who are amenable to doing workshops. So what you see on stage is only a part of what happens with our artists here.
Oh, how cool.
Like oftentimes we'll have them do a master class with students. So a dance company comes in and they will do a dance master class where students who are studying that can learn pieces of choreography and learn about the artistic inspiration for different companies. But then I also have to pay attention to what will resonate with our broader San Luis Obispo community. I mean, I would love for our entire audience to be comprised of students, but that's not the case. Depending on the genre, you know, I would say students comprise maybe anywhere from 5 to 20%, depending
on. Interesting.
Yes.
Do you have rush tickets that kids that or on a tight budget can still afford to come?
So we used to be on a rush model, but once I stepped into this position, we actually changed to having a majority of our performances have just a straight up discounted student ticket. So $15 tickets, heavily subsidized.
So that's one, like I paid $60 for a ticket. So the student might pay $15 for the same seat.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
Because I want the performances to be accessible to the students and to our whole community, in fact. And beyond the student discount, we also initiated a program called Passport to the Arts, and we're partnering with different organizations in the community that serve low-income and marginalized communities. So partnering with Housing Authority of SLO, for example, to distribute tickets to some performances for those audience members who typically would not be able to afford the performance. We want them to be able to have access. So,
But you get good response. I mean, I've been at performances that are just about sold out.
Yeah, and I say this like cautiously right now, but we've seen audiences return in a much more major way than we have over the past 2 years in recovering from the pandemic, which I'm so grateful and relieved. There are some audience members who just aren't returning after the pandemic. And so I think the last couple of years have really been an exercise in strategies of how to build new audiences, get more people into the fold, and build upon that momentum for seasons to come.
Like the symphony, do you have membership where people sign up an annual?
So we have subscriptions. So if you buy tickets for four or more shows a year, you get additional discounts, 10% off. But then we also have a VIP membership. So people who donate to support the sustainability of the organization, to support the programming, then get other benefits that go along with their tickets. And we found that to be really successful in fundraising. And it's absolutely necessary for us because I think many people probably don't know, but the majority of our shows are budgeted at a negative, even at sellout.
What role does financial viability of a performance play? Are you willing to bring somebody in, a group, even though you know it's kind of a niche one that's not going to be viral?
Yeah, I mean, financial viability does come into play, but it is not...
It's not necessarily a deal breaker.
No, it's not a deal breaker, and I wouldn't say that it's the main priority in how we curate a season. What you hope is throughout the entire season, you're going to have shows that do well and bring in some financial wins, and you plan for some that don't, and hopefully by the end of the season, you break even. And there are artists that we present that we may full well know are not known to our community, but that we feel that their artistic voice is so important that we want to introduce them to the community.
I know this is kind of amorphous, but is there a hierarchical process in your curation? You know, what would rise to the top in your response?
I'm looking at so many different things when we're looking at the season. I want to make sure that we have enough artistic disciplines represented. So, for example, I wouldn't do 20 out of our 35 performances were all jazz. We want to have that representation across the board. But I'm also looking at diversity in voices and the identities that our artists represent, the cultures that they represent. And so it's kind of this jigsaw puzzle of covering as many bases we can that way. And then just thinking about if we think there will be a draw from our audience here, and if there isn't an initial draw, is it worth sort of the outreach and the education to bring that artist here?
Hi, I'm Addie Yule, a journalism student here at Cal Poly. Just on that idea of curation, I was wondering, have you guys ever considered allowing Cal Poly students and people who don't already have like a branded name perform on the stage or get a chance to be exposed?
Yeah, I think we look for ways to have some integration of Cal Poly students with the artists that we bring. We've actually had with our jazz series last year, we brought a brilliant jazz singer, Alicia Olatuja, and she did a masterclass with the vocal jazz ensemble, and she invited students on to the stage to perform
really cool.
with her that night. Now, not every artist is up for that. She's a very special artist, but when we have those opportunities, we certainly take them. Like, that makes an artist more appealing to me when they're willing to have those sort of collaborations. I'll say that we do have some artists that we bring that are not brand name, so to speak. They may be really, really well known within the context of their country or their particular discipline, but they're artists who are not necessarily a household name. And to me, that's exciting to be able to introduce our community to them.
Have you ever considered bringing in local SLO bands? I know a lot were formed at Cal Poly or like are consisted of Cal Poly students, and they do like house shows. With that discounted ticket, like I feel like students would be really inclined to go see them at the PAC.
Yeah, I think I would consider it again in
partnership with an artist that we're bringing mm-hmm. because our mission is to bring in touring artists from all over the world, whereas local artists have other venues to be presented in that context. But I think we have a lot of success when we have those sort of collaborations that happen between local and the touring artist when they present themselves.
Yeah, totally. Very cool.
Talk to us for a moment about, in your mind, when you're curating, how it would dovetail back to different disciplines on campus, academic.
So there are some very, I think, obvious connections. Like if you have a dance company that you want to connect them to dance students. But I also like to look for connections that are beyond sort of the fine arts disciplines. Mm-hmm. So this is an example from my past arts life when I was at UC San Diego doing a similar sort of job. But we had a dancer and choreographer by the name of Huang Yi, Taiwanese choreographer. And he had a project called Huang Yi and Kuka. And Kuka was this large industrial robot arm that he had programmed and choreographed an entire piece around this robot arm in relation on the stage. It was a huge undertaking, you know, to try to figure out how to like move this 2-ton robot onto wow. a proscenium stage. But one of the great things that we did with the choreographer was, instead of having him do a masterclass, we had him go visit the robotics lab on campus.
Oh, how cool.
And talk to students who were thinking about going into robotics, studying that. And it was a really interesting conversation that I think the artist got just as much out of it as the students did. For the students, they, you know, had been thinking about who their potential clients would be in their careers. They probably weren't thinking of a dance choreographer. And so to sort of hear his perspective of what he was looking for in a robot to choreograph with, and then them bouncing ideas off each other. So I think those experiences are really rich too, or having an artist go in. We had a group called Shaolin Jazz a couple of weeks ago. They do live score DJing over kung fu films.
Wow.
Super fun. And we had them talk to students at the Black Academic Excellence Center about sort of their career path and how they carved their way creatively to create this project that is now being presented. And from my perspective, artists have something to offer students of every major, because I think talking about creative process is part of all of our lives, no matter what you decide to pursue. And those moments sometimes are the most rich and valuable moments that we have during the residency, you know, even beyond what happens on stage.
Interesting. You're right in the midst of creating your itinerary for next coming up season.
Yes.
But looking back this past year, and I know this is a subjective bias, but what was your favorite performance?
Oh, gosh.
I know.
That's so...
Yeah, which is your favorite child?
I know. That's really what you're asking me. And even when we, you know, we announce our next season, I'll sort of feel the same way. Like, I won't know which one to recommend the most, because I really vouch for all of them. Maybe I'll point to something that's recent because it's sort of top of mind. So last week we had Taj Mahal, Blues Hall of Famer Taj Mahal, multi-Grammy Award winner. And I would have been sold on bringing Taj by himself because he's such a legend. But what really, really sold me was that he brought this artist by the name of Sona Jabarte, and she's a Gambian kora player. And there's a 60 Minutes about her. She's a huge advocate for women's education in Africa. But one of the most interesting things about her is the kora is typically passed along from male relative to male relative. And it's been that way for hundreds and hundreds of years. And her father was one of the first to break the tradition and teach his daughter how to play the kora. And now she is like the most well-known female and first kora virtuoso in the world.
Wow.
So this is like breaking, you know, 700 years of tradition. So to have her on stage was incredible. And to introduce the audience to her and have so many people come out of that performance and say, oh my gosh, I had no idea who she was, and I am completely blown away. Like, those are the moments that I live for. Like, when we can expose our audience to artists or to art that they've never experienced before, and they leave changed, they leave transformed after that performance. So, on the horizon in the near term, in April, we have
a really cool collective called Small Island Big Song. And it's a collective of indigenous artists from the Pacific Islander region who have come together in this performance that, you know, it has music, it has dance, it has media. There's a whole documentary that they created. But the whole project is about raising awareness about climate change and its effect on their seafaring cultures. And it's just such a unique project. I'm really, really looking forward to bringing them here and making some connections in the community as well. They'll be doing multiple workshops, and we'll try to make as many sort of academic connections on campus for them. But that's one that I'm particularly excited about, again, and sort of exposing our audience to the new.
I'm going to turn the table on you.
Mm-hmm.
Molly Clark, you go to college. What did you think you would wind up doing?
Oh, well, that's, so I've always been a huge music person, huge music nerd. So I've played cello my whole life. In a former life, I was also a hip hop, funk and soul DJ, if you can believe that. So the arts and music have always been my heart. I did not go to college for music because I knew I wasn't a good practice room person. And if you don't like spending time in a practice room, you probably shouldn't be a music major. So I continued to play cello on my own, but I actually studied journalism.
Oh, interesting.
In college, because I knew that I was a good writer, and, you know, the decisions that you make when you're in your late teens and 20s, I said, oh, I'll do journalism. And that eventually...
Were you on the newspaper at San Diego State?
No, that at that time I was at University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
I love Madison.
Madison is such a great town.
Yeah.
Yep, that's where I grew up. It's a great town. I sort of went from journalism into marketing and then arts marketing and then arts programming and so on and so forth. So I've had the pleasure of being able to work at a number of esteemed arts and arts education institutions over the years, and really fortunate to be here in this role now. So I still feel like I'm getting my feet wet. It's been 2.5 years. My first year was when we first reopened after the pandemic. And so it's been a roller coaster of sorts, and I'm finally starting to feel grounded here with our audience.
That's really cool. Where would somebody go to learn more about what happens here?
Best place to go is calpolyarts.org. You can find information on our outreach programs, about the events coming up. You can buy your tickets, and then you can also get signed up for notifications via email or on our social media accounts as well. And I would urge people to do that now, especially as we're sort of gearing up to announce our next season in the late spring, early summer. Then you'll be the first one to be notified.
Do you take a break in the summertime?
I find that we have no break. It's just a different pace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in the summer, we're really just ramping up. We're launching the next season. So a lot of it is around sort of the publicity of that. And then we're trying to prepare as much as we can, sort of the logistics of the fall. Because once that train starts running,
get out of the way.
Yeah, it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
My name is Molly Clark, and I'm the director of Cal Poly Arts.
Molly, thank you so much for the time. This has been really, literally illuminating.
Oh, thank you. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Cal Poly State University, San Luis Obispo.
And finally, roundabouts. People love them or hate them. From an episode of Agenda Breakdown from the KCBX archives, Kim Bishop looks at the reasons behind their use on the Central Coast.
Welcome to Agenda Breakdown, a podcast that explores how cities and counties make decisions and how you can have a say. I'm Kim Bishop, and today we're going to talk about roundabouts, what they are, how they work, and why people seem to either love them or hate them. San Luis Obispo County is working on a plan to build two roundabouts on Highway 227, one at Los Ranchos Road and one at Buckley Road. This is happening in a part of town where traffic congestion has been getting worse in recent years. I'm here with Professor Anurag Pandey, who teaches transportation engineering at Cal Poly. I asked him to help us understand the role of roundabouts and why they may be coming to an intersection near you. Welcome, Anurag.
Thank you, Kim. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about roundabouts, one of my favorite subjects. Thanks.
When I first reached out to you about this, I actually used the term traffic circle instead of roundabout, and you very kindly explained that the two are not, in fact, the same. Can you start by telling us what are roundabouts and how are they different from traffic circles?
Oh, for sure. You know, there are two terms that sort of are my pet peeves, right? So in traffic safety, I work in traffic safety and traffic engineering. So roundabout versus traffic circle is one of them. And the other one is crashes versus accidents. We want to use the term crashes rather than accidents when we're talking about what happens in traffic on our roads. And this one's not as bad, obviously, but still, I always want to make sure that we are using the correct terminology here. So roundabouts are different from traffic circles because traffic circles could involve stop signs, stop signals, or no control at all to get into that rotary. In roundabout, what we have is always a yield at entry rule. So that's one big difference. And then vehicles have to wait for the appropriate gap to get into the roundabout. And also roundabouts have this design features that are there to reduce the entering speed for the vehicles. And as the vehicles enter, as they circulate, they're really supposed to have lower speeds by design. So there are design features within the roundabout that make sure that you are entering and circulating in the roundabout at a smaller speed. And you don't see those features in traffic circles or rotaries of the old days.
I've heard that term, slowing speeds by design, a lot lately. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So what happens is that when you have a roundabout, you have flared approaches, you have entry angles to make sure that as vehicles are approaching, they cannot quite maintain their same speed and they have to slow down. And that has some interesting implications for safety, of course, but also for actually increasing the capacity that we observe in roundabout. Typically, we think of facilities that have smaller speeds to have lower capacity. But in the case of a roundabout, because you have intersecting traffic, lower speeds can actually help us increase the efficiency. And we can get to that a little bit later. But those are the big differences between traffic circles and roundabouts. And what Caltrans is planning to install, by the way, and what we install nowadays in modern times, they're all roundabouts. We don't usually do traffic circles anymore, unless it's a very, very small neighborhood type circle. And, you know, these old traffic circles used to be very big as well, very large circle in the middle. And roundabouts have smaller circle in the middle to make sure that we have design features that are conducive to slower speeds.
Well, it seems like we're seeing a lot more roundabouts in Slo County lately. Why is that?
So not just Slo County, actually. You could extrapolate that to throughout the state, really. And in fact, all across the country. And partly why that's happening is because they are, in fact, safer. So this is, I would say, is a case of evidence-based planning and engineering. We knew from intuition that roundabouts would be safer. And now as more and more states and more municipalities are installing them, we're also finding that that is the case also in experience. So we are seeing fewer crashes. We are seeing, compared to signalized intersections, obviously we are seeing more crashes overall in our country. And that's a separate matter of conversation. But on intersections that used to be traffic signals or four-way stop or two-way stop control intersections, when we convert them into roundabouts, we invariably see fewer crashes and certainly even fewer severe crashes. And that, again, is by design. And that experience is leading engineers and planners to consider roundabouts more and more. And that's why you're seeing them more and more. And the other thing about roundabouts is that when they first are put in a community has some concerns about it. But as community matures in their interactions with those roundabouts and driving through and biking through and walking through those roundabouts, those elements become more popular.
So when I'm looking at that section of Highway 227, is there anything in particular about that scenario that lends itself to a roundabout as a solution?
Yeah, for sure. So they were looking at is essentially a five-lane corridor where you have two lanes in each direction and then two-way left turn lane in the middle. And then the scenario where you could put in the roundabout. And the benefit of the roundabout is that you're not adding extra capacity in the middle of the sections and you are only taking care of the bottleneck and you're introducing that increased capacity at the intersection where the bottleneck used to be. And the advantage of that is that by not adding that extra capacity along the whole corridor, it really not inducing that extra demand that sometimes comes in when you expand capacity, but it's not really needed. So that's one big benefit of using roundabouts rather than expanding the whole section to five lanes and going there. And the other thing is that they looked at, so roundabouts sometimes could be problematic because at the intersection, you need a big right-of-way. And when you need a big right-of-way, you have to acquire that right-of-way, and that could sometimes be prohibitively expensive. But that obviously was not the case here, because when they did the benefit cost analysis, taking into account the benefits we will get in terms of the reduced collisions, the improved efficiency of travel, when they looked at all of that and compared that to the cost of building a roundabout and cost of having a traffic signal and maintaining that traffic signal, they obviously the comparisons came out ahead in terms of the benefit cost ratio. So that wasn't a concern. So that's why the roundabouts, I think, will work really well there. And we can talk about why folks might have some concerns.
You're listening to Agenda Breakdown. I'm Kim Bischoff, and I'm here today with Cal Poly Professor Anurag Pandey. Why do people get so fired up about this? I've heard so many really strong opinions about it. And it seems like, you know, from what I'm hearing from you, it seems like the research really favors roundabouts in terms of safety and efficiency. What's happening there?
So let me first talk about why roundabouts are safer and why they are more efficient, even with the slower speeds. And then let's talk about why people might have some concerns about it. First of all, roundabouts are safer because if you have a traditional sort of four-legged intersection, the collisions that happen there sometimes are a result of the conflicts between the crossing vehicles and the vehicles that are on the intersecting streets. So the collisions that happen by user error or by design or whatever it is, they tend to be more severe because they are T-bone type collisions. But when you're talking about collisions, even if they do occur on a roundabout, they are more sort of merging conflicts related collisions. And those tend to be less severe because you're not talking about crossing conflicts, you're just talking about merging conflicts. And merging conflicts lead to less severe collisions. And in terms of the efficiency, what happens is that why roundabouts add more efficiency sometimes is that, first of all, you're not making complete stop and starting from complete stop. A lot of the times, if you're on the main street, you are sort of having that continuous flow without having to stop for a very long time and starting back up again. So that is one advantage. The other advantage is that because the roundabout slows down the traffic, the gaps that you need to enter the intersection are not as large. So think about this. If you have very fast moving traffic and you are the person who wants to merge into that traffic, you would be looking for a much larger gap. But if the traffic is moving at a smaller speed, you can enter the same stream of traffic with a much smaller gap. And that's what makes the slower speed and leads to more efficiency on a roundabout, because roundabouts are slowing down the speed by design. And that's why as a road user, even if you're entering from a side street, you are much more comfortable entering with the small gaps. And because those smaller gaps are not going to waste anymore, now you have additional capacity added on. So there is efficiency and safety related advantages of having a roundabout. Now, why do people don't like that? Part of that is obviously the concerns about being unfamiliar. There are folks that think of them, maybe they have that impression of those old time rotaries or traffic circles from the age past. I think those concerns are completely valid, but with those types of intersections, we don't have those anymore. We have modern roundabouts, which are definitely better. So there is that fear of the unknown or the unfamiliar, but I don't want to completely reject out of hand the community concerns. Part of the concerns also comes from that the road users might be thinking that they won't find acceptable gaps in traffic if they live in those communities, and they're thinking, if there is no traffic signal, how am I going to try to merge onto the traffic that's moving so fast? But the reality is that once you have the roundabout, the traffic won't be moving as fast. You won't be needing that large of a gap that you're used to needing right now. So because the traffic is not going to be zooming past at that previous high speeds, you're going to have actually many more acceptable gaps. And obviously in the study that the Caltrans and SLOCOG and Rick Engineering and Kimley Horn jointly conducted, and so all of these organizations, by the way, employ Cal Poly grads, graduates from our program and the urban planning program. I trust those folks for sure. So they've looked at those things very carefully, and they've found that, yes, in fact, there would be sufficient gaps available for folks to join in.
I have one more question for you. Mm-hmm. How do bicyclists and pedestrians fit into the picture here?
There is some concerns about pedestrians that might happen, especially with regards to accessibility issue. There are ways of addressing those concerns. When you're talking about a signal, you can provide that, you know, auditory signal to visually impaired pedestrians, and that could work there. But the one big advantage of roundabout is that because you're able to do some traffic calming, because you're able to bring down some speeds, again, overall, it's a much safer environment for pedestrians and bicyclists as well. Now, bicyclists, there, if you look at the roundabouts that have been built in the city of San Luis Obispo recently, I live in San Luis Obispo, and near where we live, there are several roundabouts, and they have provided those provisions for bicyclists so that they can cross that roundabout much more easily away from the stream of traffic. And because there is some speed reduction features that go with the roundabout, they really make the environment safer overall.
Thank you so much, Anurag. It's been such a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kim.
Now it's time for today's action item. For now, your job is just to do a little learning. The County Department of Public Works has an FAQ that addresses some of the myths about roundabouts, how to use them if you're on foot or on a bike. So study up, friends. I'm Kim Bishop. See you next time on Agenda Breakdown.
This conversation was taken from an episode of Agenda Breakdown, which originally aired on KCBX in March of 2022. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.